who is the most famous person in international healthcare? Who is the most famous person in medical missions? Who's the most exemplary role model in the world of tropical medicine? Anybody come to mind? Big names in this field. Mother Teresa. There are not a lot of big names in this field. That's right. We don't go into this because we want to become famous or make a name for ourselves. But there are a few people that your great-grandparents probably know all about. Albert Schweitzer. You know, he was the German physician who worked in West Africa in the 50s and 60s. You know, I grew up with Tom Dooley, the U.S. Navy physician in charge of refugee care at the outset of the Vietnam War. And then more recently, there have been individuals like Paul Farmer. But what do you know about David Livingstone? Now, you and I know of Livingstone as the great explorer, the person who discovered the origin of the Nile River, the first person we know of that crossed the continent of Africa. But his life was actually way more interesting than that. He was born in total poverty. His father homeschooled him into the University of Glasgow, where he met inspiring people like you. And he got this vision for the world. And so as a young physician, David Livingstone arrived in what is now South Africa, where he was immediately mauled by a lion. It crushed his brachial plexus, and his right arm hung limp at his side his entire life. But that didn't stop him. In his autobiography, Livingstone describes his first 10 years in Africa as the happiest time in his life. He was raising his family. He was sharing Christ in a church. He was taking care of sick Africans. And it was only after that that he began to travel, for which we know him today. Now, unlike the explorers of that era, Livingstone did not travel with an army. Normally, it was just him and some porters and some guides, and so everywhere he went, he was greeted as this interesting outsider. He wrote extensively about the life of the Africans as he traveled, and Livingstone, in retrospect, is credited with the downfall of slavery in the British Empire. Now, how is that possible? This obscure physician in faraway lands. But he described Africans as people, as individuals with dreams and aspirations and hopes. And he set the scene for the legislation that was introduced by William Wilberforce later on to eventually eliminate slavery in the British Empire. Now, he was one of the most remarkable people of the 1800s, devoted follower of Christ. And as best we know, Livingstone died of malaria and dysentery. And now here we are, almost 200 years later, in the internet age, and malaria and dysentery are still killing people. Now, when I say diseases connected with poverty, what do I mean? How would you define poverty? Somebody raise your hand. What is poverty?
Chronic lack of resources.
Okay, what else? Poverty is?
Inability to meet basic needs.
Sometimes it is described in terms of hopelessness, lack of role models. But usually we use a financial number on it. It's living on less than $3 a day. And so if you look at the world in the red countries, yeah, nations closely associated with poverty, right now poverty is skyrocketing in some countries. What countries come to mind?
Haiti.
Haiti, okay, Haiti.
Venezuela.
Burundi.
Ghana.
Ghana.
Gaza. In short, wherever there is a natural disaster or wherever there is war going on, poverty is rising dramatically at this very moment. And of course, every country, no matter how wealthy, has got pockets of poverty. We see it in India, we see it in China, we see it in the United States. Pockets of poverty everywhere. Well, I want to introduce you to a statistic in a moment, but I want to begin with the most basic health statistic of all. Did you know that women live longer than men? Do you know why? You see, men have this particular approach to life's problems. You know, we will find a solution. We will innovate. Give us some duct tape and some super glue. And it can start at a very young age. Give us some twine and a bungee cord. We'll find a solution. I find this one rather shocking. What are they thinking? And it's been going on a long time. Women living longer than men. Just imagine. Well, the measure that we're going to use to weigh the gravity of health problems is called the DALY. It's called the Disability Adjusted Life Year Lost. I see some of you are nodding your heads. You're familiar with the DALY. And for those who aren't, let me explain. If an 80-year-old dies of pneumonia, how many people died? One person died. If an 8-day-old dies of pneumonia, how many people died? One person died. But the gravity of those deaths is dramatically different. You know, the 80-year-old has already outlived projected life expectancy. The 8-day-old has lost 80 years of projected life. And so what the DALY does is it takes into account not only what kills someone, but how old are they when they actually die. And so if you think about the world's 50 poorest countries, what do you suppose are those diseases that cause the most life years lost? Name some diseases. Malaria. Diarrhea. HIV. Malnutrition. Now, this is important because this helps us to prioritize our health efforts. So if you look at the world's 50 poorest countries, the leading cause of life years lost is pneumonia, is diarrhea, is malaria, is HIV, diseases that primarily affect children because the death of one child represents a lot of life years lost. Now, we can use some other kind of health indicators. Life expectancy, child mortality. What's the risk of a child dying before they start school? So if you look at all low-income countries, you know, life expectancy is about 60. About 10% of their children die before they go to school. If you look at high-income countries at the very bottom, way less than 1% of our children die before they start school. And then in the far right column, we have health expenditure. You know, how much money are we spending per person in order to protect their health? Now, I've included some particular countries that have the world's worst health statistics. Keep an eye on those countries. We'll come back to them in a moment. Health status is closely connected with economic status. Now, I'm going to show you some images, and then I'm going to ask you, what do you see? So this is poverty. This is HIV infection, tuberculosis, malaria, malnutrition, malaria, TB, HIV, poverty. What do you notice about these? Same areas, lots of overlap. Nations of poverty are also the nations of these particular diseases. Now, in that column I showed you a little earlier, you notice that malnutrition was not listed as a cause of death. Why not?
It contributes to every other death.
It contributes to every other death. That's right. People normally don't die of malnutrition. They are malnourished, and then they get pneumonia or malaria or dysentery. You can imagine a child like this with one of those infectious diseases who's profoundly malnourished to start with. Then it is the significant contributor towards death. Over half of childhood deaths in low-income countries have malnutrition as a significant risk factor for them. Health status and economic status, closely related. Now, I want you to think of these children in southern China. Why do you suppose those children living under such conditions would be more likely to suffer from an infectious disease? Poor water, poor sanitation, crowded living conditions, impaired immunity, climate, less vaccinations. What about their access to medical care? Probably exposure to insect vectors. Probably a dirt floor in their home. Probably poor nutrition. Closely connected. About 70% of childhood deaths in low-income countries are due to which one of these causes? Who's interested in pediatrics? All right, about a third of you. Interested in peds. So you need to know this. An infectious disease. And the five big killers of children in low-income countries are? Tell me. Pneumonia. Diarrhea. Malaria. Tuberculosis. That's right. HIV used to be among the top five. Not anymore. Thank goodness. The fifth one is vaccine-preventable, primarily measles. So the big five killers of children, pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, tuberculosis, vaccine-preventable. And that's what if you're going to be doing child health in these kind of circumstances, then those are especially diseases you need to know how to both treat and prevent. Health status is closely connected with economic status. One of the most fascinating studies was done in India, where they found that people with low hemoglobin also had low income. People with high hemoglobins had high income. So how much work can you do if your hemoglobin is 3? Probably do a lot better if your hemoglobin was 13. And then the intervention was to treat everybody with a hemoglobin of 3, with deworming medication, with iron supplementation. And the researchers found that as their hemoglobin rose, guess what happened to their income? It also rose. That's right. Health status, economic status, very closely connected. So how is it that people who are physically more healthy are able to generate more economic growth? They can work. And in order for an economy to function, you need to have both production and consumption. So people need to be healthy enough to work to generate income, and then they also need to be healthy enough to go to the market and buy stuff. And so the cycle continues. Now, the opposite is also true. Economic growth spurs greater physical health in what ways? Access to water, better nutrition, infrastructure, access to health care, better working conditions,
less stress.
So one of the most important ways to fight diseases connected with poverty is actually to grow an economy. As the economy grows, you get better roads, you get fewer traffic accidents, you have better work circumstances, you have homes that are protected from insect vectors, safer drinking water, better nutrition. Now, we saw this in the United States. So let's look at health in the U.S. in 1900. you know. Men were living to be about 40, 45. Women, a little bit more than that. And then since then, life expectancy in the U.S. has been gradually rising. It was abysmal at the turn of the last century. Black men were living to be about 30. White men were living to be mid-40s. Well, what was killing people back then? Tuberculosis. That's right. Consumption. Now, what we're looking at here is a lung. This is a lung. You see those big cavities within it? Those are that is cavitary tuberculosis, where the TB has destroyed the lung parenchyma. Other leading killers at that time were also influenza, rheumatic heart disease, all diseases connected with contagions. Now, people living in rural America, they were living into their 60s and 70s. Why? They were not exposed to tuberculosis and influenza, which was present in the cities at that time. Now, somebody realized this. In the 1920s, New York City began limiting the number of people who could live in a house. And what it did was almost immediately broke the transmission of tuberculosis. They also introduced public water systems and sanitation systems, and the impact was dramatic. Within 40 years, blacks were living almost twice as long, whites were living 50% longer than before, and it was because they controlled tuberculosis transmission and provided safe drinking water. It had very little at all to do with medical therapy. You know, the first antibiotic was introduced when? There were sulfa drugs in the 1920s. Penicillin came in the 1940s. And this progress in health in our country happened before then. Which brings us back to this whole question of how do we define health? When I was a medical student at the University of Missouri, my esteemed professor said, if you do a history and a physical and you can't find any disease, the person's healthy. Right? Most of you are saying no. So what is health then? Well, there's the WHO definition that you all are aware of. You know, it's the state of complete social, physical, emotional, social well-being, not just the absence of disease. Now, it does sound a bit utopian, but it's really true that our physical health is closely connected with industry, economics, politics, education system. They rise and fall together. And so my first point this afternoon is that if we want to effectively fight diseases connected with poverty, we, healthcare professionals, must advocate for economic development. What? What do we know about economic development? We know that it works. Growing economies contribute greatly to people's physical health. Now, some of you have seen economic development in progress. Give me some examples of what you have seen.
Microloans,
yes.
Small businesses.
Starting small businesses. Transportation.
Educating women.
Improved farming techniques. Now, probably what you have witnessed has been small-scale things, but small-scale things can be scaled up. Now, you mentioned a moment ago about educating women. Particularly powerful. What this graph shows is the relationship between whether a young mother can read and what's the risk of her baby dying. And on the horizontal axis, we have got literacy. So if she is highly literate in the far right lower corner, those women have a very low risk of their children dying. But if these women are highly illiterate, in the upper left corner, there's a much higher risk of their children dying. Why is that the case? Why is it that young mothers who can read have children who don't die? Okay, if they can read, then they can problem solve, they can figure out how to treat their sick child. What's another reason?
Avoid the problems before they happen.
Avoid the problems before they happen.
Economic.
Economic, tell me more about that.
Economic work, because of better literacy, improves their life, their conditions in life, abilities to have jobs.
A woman who can read has more power, has more ability to get a better job, to afford health care, to afford a better home, to afford better nutrition, better access to transportation that she might need for vaccinations. Yes, it empowers the woman if she has some basic education. Who's familiar with Heifer International? So Heifer is headquartered in Little Rock, but they work throughout the developing world as well as in the United States. And their model is to increase the economic health of a family. They'll give them a goat, they'll show them how to milk the goat, reproduce the goat, slaughter the goat, sell the goat, use the animal to produce income. And what Heifer has found is that communities that are receiving this kind of animal husbandry also have better physical health. They have less child mortality because the family has got more resources to work with. Now, I witnessed this in my career. I began with 2 years working at the charity hospital in Shanghai, China. And China at that time was an impoverished country. What we cared for at Shanghai Charity was mainly tuberculosis and rheumatic fever and schistosomiasis, diseases connected with low income. People in Shanghai were living on $20 a month, at that time. Now, beyond what was going on in the 80s and 90s in China, they introduced some economic reforms, and the economy began to take off. Well, along with that, so has life expectancy in China. It's been gradually growing since that time. We don't see tuberculosis at Shanghai Charity Hospital anymore. No more schistosomiasis, no more of those preventable infectious diseases. Physical health and economic development are inextricably linked. Stronger economic conditions foster greater health in all the following ways, except which one?
D.
D, fertility. What happens to fertility as economies grow?
Decreases.
So women tend to have fewer children. The children that they do bear tend to be healthier. The women themselves tend to be healthier as a result of this transition in fertility that accompanies economic growth. Secondly, if we really want to fight the diseases connected with poverty, we must advocate to end military conflict. What? That is not a political statement. That is a public health statement. Who dies in today's wars? You've been following what's going on in Gaza. Who is it that's dying?
Non-combatants,
women and children. The most vulnerable of society are the ones who are dying. Now, it's difficult to do research when there's a war going on. These nations in red are nations at war or recently at war, nations that have the very worst health statistics in terms of life expectancy and child mortality and financial investment into health. The British Medical Journal was actually successful in doing some data collection during the wars in Eastern Congo. And they write, in many war zones, violent deaths are often only a tiny proportion of overall deaths, and deaths from infectious diseases usually outweigh deaths from violence. of an excess mortality of 2.5 million people, 350,000 died of violence, almost everyone else, malnutrition and infectious diseases. And so for this reason, we as healthcare professionals step in to that space and we say, there must be a solution to this violence. So I witnessed this in the second part of my career was in Angola, a nation in southern Africa. You all know where Angola is located, don't you? But you would like to know. All right. So when you look at the continent of Africa, Africa looks like this. So here's the desert and Kenya's down here. Angola is the right knee of the continent of Africa. And so I spent a couple of years in Angola. I was invited there by a coalition of churches that wanted to do something for health in that context, but they had been fighting their civil war already for 30 years. You know, and as a result, there were no schools, money was worthless, all the men were gone. Where were the men? It was a nation of orphans and widows. What happened to the men? They had died in the war, that's right. Or they had been kidnapped as child soldiers to fight in the war. Now, we were not set up to do hunger relief. You know, we were working just day by day in this kind of setting that had no infrastructure whatsoever, caring for people who were suffering from diseases that should not exist. You know, measles vaccine is 80% effective. If a population is vaccinated against measles, it essentially will not happen. Will not be transmitted from one to another because of herd immunity. And yet, we saw measles every day. Why? No vaccination, because no way to get the vaccine in, because there were landmines everywhere. We also were managing malaria. Now, this was the era in which we had bed nets and we had antimalarial drugs that were effective, and yet everybody had malaria because no bed nets, few antimalarials, and lots of malnutrition. Well, Angola is an agriculturally rich country, lots of corn and soybean, and how can you go out in your fields if there's landmines? And so we early figured out the solution. You've got to stop the war. Until there is peace, we cannot make any progress against these kind of diseases. We were not set up for hunger relief. You know, we were medical care. And yet, I would go out on my veranda and I would see people like these. And if you look carefully, you see most of them are holding a little tin can. The rain had not come that year. Their corn was not growing. And they would say to me, "Oh, doctor, por favor, tengo mucho fome, a minha familia não tem comida, nada en casa." "Doctor, we haven't had any food in our house in a week. We are so hungry. Give us something." And I think to myself, we're not set up to do hunger relief, but okay. So we went in the kitchen and got a vat and boiled some cornmeal and put in a little bit of cabbage, and we brought the vat out, and these people leapt to their feet and they rushed forward with their can to dip up some of that soup. And in the chaos, the vat spilled over. Everyone went away hungry. Well, the next morning I got up, and they were back again, and they had their little can, and they said, "Please, please, can we have something?" And I thought, "Oh, what am I going to do now?" And then I remember the account of Jesus feeding the 5,000. If you read it carefully, it says he had them sit down in groups of 20s and 30s, and I think I know why. I think it was crowd control. And so while the porridge was being made, I went out and I had them get in little groups, and I appointed a leader for each group. And I said, yeah, you control your people. And then when we brought the food out, they came up one by one and they dipped out their food and they got fed that day. And then it began to rain. And the corn began to grow. And Angola got a peace accord. And now it's been 15 years with no fighting, and they're starting to dig up those landmines. Malaria is way down. Measles is way down. Malnutrition is way down. None of that progress was going to happen until the war was addressed. I returned from Angola and started teaching public health at the University of Missouri. And I was approached by all of these young healthcare students, PT students, pharmacy students, medicine, nursing, and they said, we want to do what you did as well. Can you help us get started? And so I began to develop a curriculum. Today it is it's a graduate certificate in international health that was designed to cover the gaps in their healthcare education. You know, they weren't learning anything about malaria and schistosomiasis in school, but yet if you're going to work in these kind of settings, they needed to have some basic understanding of these diseases. They needed some hands-on skills. You know, how to resuscitate a newborn, how to manage extremity trauma. So many people going through health profession school today are not taught basic clinical skills. And then most importantly, I found people like you, Miss Peggy, Clinica Esperanza, Honduras, who would be preceptors for our learners. And we would send them to work with them for a month or two at a time in 40 different countries to have some actual supervised experience. How do you do healthcare in that kind of setting? People who would not just provide an observership, but who would give them opportunity within their skills to actually practice the things that they have learned. And then to acknowledge the value of that credential. Today we offer them a graduate certificate or even a master's degree in international health so that they enter the field with some basic understanding and some skills to move forward. If we really want to fight the diseases connected with poverty, then there are certain interventions that are especially effective, interventions that we need to be aware of. And the way I want to approach that is to prioritize those leading health problems. Now, let me say, I'm going to finish in 5 or 10 minutes, and I want you to be thinking if you have got some advice for the group. Maybe you have got some personal experience that you want to share with the group. What has worked in your experience for fighting diseases connected with poverty? What have you witnessed regarding economic development or education or peacemaking as avenues to advocate for greater health? Be thinking of that, and I'm going to open it up in a moment. So let's start with the number one cause of life years lost, pneumonia. Now, in North America, we usually think of pneumonia as an old person's disease. But in most of the low-income world, pneumonia is a disease of small children. One morning in Angola, there was a knock at my door, and there was a woman holding a baby who was gasping. And I said, how long has he been sick? And she said, well, for about a week. And how have you treated him? And, well, I went to the pharmacy, but they didn't have anything. And I didn't want to bother you, doctor. And clearly, the kid was just about to go into respiratory arrest, you know, from his pneumonia. So we gave him an injection of ceftriaxone, and we gave him some supplemental oxygen, but it was just too late. Died within a couple of hours. What are the organisms that kill kids like that? What were we treating? I hear strep pneumo. Haemophilus. See, if you want to manage childhood pneumonia, leading cause of life years lost, then you need to know some of these things. And I'm going to let you off easy. There is nothing exotic about pneumonia. All right, it is the very same organisms. It's the very same antibiotics that you're used to using in North America that cause pneumonia the world over. Now, this is an enormous health problem. So put on your public health hat for a moment. If you were trying to find a solution to pneumonia in Uganda or in Honduras or in Afghanistan, you know, killing thousands of kids every year, what would you do? What would be effective?
Vaccine.
All right, I hear vaccines. Do a survey of the community to find out what are their living conditions. What else could be effective against community-wide pneumonia?
Education. Education.
Education.
The mothers get the baby to the doctor sooner.
Okay, get the baby to the doctor sooner. Yes.
Isolating the sick people.
Sanitation.
Nutrition.
Now, there are certain vaccines that are effective in preventing childhood pneumonia, like Pneumovax, RSV, influenza vaccine, Haemophilus vaccine. Do you have those? The people from Honduras are saying, no, we don't have that. So in Angola, where I still work, we don't have any of those vaccines. They're expensive. Relatively expensive. So we're just left with straight DPT, oral polio. Nothing has advanced much because of the relative cost of those vaccines. What else can we do? Better nutrition.
Teaching early signs.
Teaching early signs. Thank you, Christelle. So if you were educating a young mother, young father, about early signs of pneumonia, what would you tell them? Rapid breathing.
Fever.
Cough. Retractions, chest retractions. Poor fluid intake. Diapers not wet. So if your child has any of these signs, then seek medical attention, right? Get them treated. Now, who's going to treat them? So in an effort to provide some kind of basic medical care throughout the low-income world, many countries today make use of community health workers or health promoters, or village health workers, or promotores de saúde. Now, we would normally expect a high school-trained health promoter to be able to do all of these things, except which one? The skill set is, of course, going to vary depending upon the setting, but generally, who has worked with community health workers before? Yeah, many of you. One of the biggest challenges is finding people who are wedded to the community, because there's this tendency to get some education and then leave the community and go to the big city and try to make money or something else. And so we need to support their skills, you know, not just their initial training, which is usually 4 months or 6 months, but also reinforcing their training periodically. But experience has shown is that if you give them a lot of education, then they often will leave. And so working out a balance for reinforcing them, congratulating them, you know, equipping them, but also encouraging them to stay on serving their communities is really critical. All right, second leading cause of life years lost, diarrhea disease. What has been effective in your experience against preventing diarrhea, especially in children?
Clean water.
Breastfeeding. Oral rehydration solution.
Separating the animals from where
people are getting their water from.
Latrines.
What are some ways of making water safe to drink?
Boil it, filter it.
Solar, light, sunlight, yes.
Deep wells,
yes. Who has a water bottle here? You got one of those clear plastic water bottles from lunch? All right, let's see one. Yeah. So if you have got contaminated water and you put it in one of these clear plastic containers and put it in the sun for 6 hours, the UV light will kill whatever organisms are in there. Now, it'll still look turbid. It still might not look good to drink. But it doesn't require cutting down any trees to boil any water. Very effective. What we did in our particular community was we brought in some specialists, some hydrologists, water engineers who dug a deep well. It went down 100 meters, and the water that came out was drinkable without any purification at all. And the diarrhea disease in our community evaporated. Just with an engineering solution that had nothing to do with antibiotic therapy or even oral rehydration solution. Which of you are in communities where safe drinking water is an issue? Yeah, many of you. And as you're looking for water solutions, you will quickly discover, if you haven't already, that you also have to address sanitation. So in our city in Angola, the government came through and they said, yeah, we're gonna provide, you know, this system of water outlets, of taps in the city. But they didn't do anything about waste disposal. And so it was very quickly contaminated, and then we had to go back and start over again, providing sanitation. The two just have to be hand in hand. And then there are other things. Besides safe drinking water and sanitation, you also may need to address what else? Children who die of diarrhea often also have
malnutrition.
That's right. So as you encourage breastfeeding, as you provide better nutrition support, then the children will be relatively protected when they are threatened by an intercurrent illness. Malaria. Most people who die of malaria are whom? They are children and pregnant women. Yeah, gravid women are extraordinarily sensitive to death from malaria. And in some endemic zones, we actually give all the pregnant women prophylaxis, you know, during the last two trimesters. What are we doing about the epidemic of malaria? What kind of interventions have you seen? Mosquito nets?
Vaccine?
Permethrin impregnated bed nets? Treating standing water? Yes.
There's experiments with breeding mosquitoes that are infertile. They can't reproduce.
That's right. So there are some serious interventions going on breeding mosquitoes that cannot reproduce, you know, with a little bit of genetic intervention here. Now, there was a new malaria vaccine introduced about 5 years ago. In southern Africa, it required 4 shots. It was designed for children like ages 4 through 6. It was about 20% efficacious in reducing malaria. Now, that doesn't sound like much to us, but actually in that context, it did lead to a significant decline in deaths from malaria. What's the big news now about malaria vaccine? Just about 8 weeks ago, there was the WHO approved a new malaria vaccine that is about 80% efficacious. It's still four shots, and it is still designed for children who are most vulnerable, you know, from the disease. So we have greater hope of actually controlling malaria today than we did. Now, in the meantime, bed nets are really the mainstay in endemic regions. In Angola, bed nets are used for lots of stuff. Fishing nets, wedding gowns, lingerie. But where they are used appropriately, they not only protect the child who is sleeping under the net, but also everyone else in the house who is not under the net. How's that possible? Permethrin impregnated in the net kills the mosquitoes that are in the room as well. Now, protection for the entire family. Which one of the following is not a mechanism by which malaria control is being pursued today? What do you think? All of these are effective against malaria today except well, in the 1990s, there was this great idea. Why don't we just give chloroquine to everybody who is at risk for malaria? And they rolled it out in Southeast Asia. You know, the rainy season has started. We're going to give all the kids chloroquine. And what happened? We got drug resistance, and now chloroquine is not useful for much of anything. So it was a nice idea, but it didn't actually work that way. So to sum up, if we are serious about fighting diseases connected with poverty, we must advocate for economic development. Raises all boats. We must advocate to end military conflict because it's the women and children who are actually dying. And we must advocate particularly effective interventions like these three that we just discussed. Continue defending the poor. David Livingstone would be very proud of you. Now, share with me some of your own experience. Who has a pearl for the group or a story for the group? What's worked for you? Please.
I know we work in Ghana, and everybody who has horrible wounds.
Can you speak up?
We work in Ghana, so we have a medical clinic and a school we run, and my husband and I run there. But I found that when we went back last time and we had all these horrible wounds, well, they're washing their wounds in the lake water. So as soon as we started doing just teaching, a fourth of a bar of soap and a washcloth, their wounds started to disappear, some without antibiotics. It was just the clean water they needed.
Yeah, clean water to wash wounds with that led, instead of lake water, to wash the wounds with much better healing. This is my contact. If you'd like to be in touch with me, please give me a scan and let me know. All right, who else has a story for us?
Here's one.
Yes, please.
I'm also a neighbor of Angola, where you were. So thank you very much for your work. Angola and Nigeria had a dependency on one item, which is the oil.
Oil, dependency
and
on oil.
That can be a problem also creating. You mentioned Angola has gifted with, God gifted agricultural, but they did not pursue it. And Nigeria, the same thing. They depend very much on one petroleum. And when that falls down, the whole thing should go down.
Yeah, so in the case of Angola and Nigeria, the dependence of the economy has been on oil primarily, and then when the price of oil goes down, so does everything else. So diversifying the economy. Thank you, sir. Please.
I work in Kenya, East Africa, and still a difficult area. I just want to advocate, you know, we're all looking at medical missions and the power of the gospel to turn around poverty, because it changes your attitude towards stewardship of your resources. Our church is the people who are giving literacy classes to the women in the community so that the women can learn to read. And the husbands, they stop drinking. They start actually wanting to work. So I know that wasn't in your presentation, so I just wanted to remind everyone that in our community, it's been the gospel that's changed things. We've had people come to us and say, could you share the Bible with us? And then we go to the community and we find out they don't have clean water. So then we can recognize what they need and we'll talk to them. Do you want a well? And then they can get clean water as well. But it started with the gospel and with people opening their hearts up to changing something very essential, because then it changes the way they handle their communities.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. The power of the gospel to transform people. Please.
We worked in different jungle tribes in Peru, and this one village among the Chatanawa people, it was the worst place to go. The illness was just so high in every aspect. The gospel came in, and people just cleaned hygiene around there, and the illness brought to almost nothing.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Please.
It's really a simple one, but
we were
trying to teach people how to boil water and things, but it never dawned on us that they didn't have anything to boil it in. So sometimes you have to think beyond the problem on how to solve it. Just something simple, like a tin can or something. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have the means to boil it, and so they were like, you know, yeah, I'll do it, but, you know, they never could do it until we thought further into the problem. And that's
it. Yeah, just provision of something that they could boil their water in. Yes.
Not my story, but just making sure that there's community buy-in. When things in Africa were much more colonial, the Dutch would pay communities to do the latrine. When the doctor got tired of retreating them all the time for worms and diarrhea, they said, listen, I'm not coming back until everybody has a functioning latrine. He came back in a month. And there were latrines, but not for the widows. And they said, well, why don't the widows have them? And they said, well, because the Dutch didn't find them. So they're like, well, they still need a latrine. I'll come back in another month. And so then when everybody had it, they treated everybody at the same time, kids were healthier. Then the next village said, wait, what did you do in that village? But they had to get buy-in and explanation, as opposed to the wrong reason, which was not to get fined by the Dutch when they were a colony. So they had to see the benefit and have buy-in themselves.
Yeah, community buy-in in order for the intervention to take hold. One more, please, Peggy.
We started giving prenatal vitamins to all females over 13, not if they're pregnant, but when they're pregnant.
Right.
And just the folic acid stops so many of the prenatal or the birth defects, like hydrocephaly, spinal bifida, and cleft palate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, provision of prenatal vitamin, folate containing vitamin to every woman of childbearing age. There we go. Exactly. Thank you so much for joining me today. I would love to talk with you afterwards. I also put my card on the two counters in the back of the room if you'd like to pick up and be in touch with me.